Reflection. Made to be like him. Introduction. The consensus in the media is Christianity is outdated. The comments made by comedians on panel shows, the remarks of a talk show host, and the portrayal of Christians in drama leave us in no doubt. To be a Christian is to be stuck in the Dark Ages. This puts us off giving it another thought. Technological advances are enormous and do not appear to be slowing down. When I was growing up, you needed a landline to make a phone call, and the computers my dad worked with filled a whole room. Now the computers we carry in our pockets are more powerful. If we want, we can phone people with them. While our grandparents may have prayed to an imaginary being, we no longer do. When we want to talk, need help, or wish to consider our thoughts, we blog, tweet, or leave a Facebook message. Our mortality is getting better all the time, and medical advances ensure many illnesses no longer cause us the problems they once did. Whatever needs our ancestors had for putting their faith in a higher being is gone. You may agree that belief in God is no longer credible. Well, the aim of this book is not to argue that God is credible. My intention is to take it a step further. I wish to argue that everything we hold dear is only credible because we've been created by the God who is Trinity. Reflection. Made to be like him. Chapter 1. Love. Pupils pigeonhole their teachers. When the IT teacher runs out on the football field, shouts from the sideline are, "Sir, I didn't know you could play football." If the French teacher attends the Annie dress rehearsal with her trumpet, hecklers call out, "Miss, can you really play that thing?" As every child knows, teachers belong in the classroom. When everyone else has gone home, they remain at their desks. The maths teacher turns to the latest edition of More Hard Sums. The science teacher reaches for her white coat and returns to her alchemy. While the English teacher's only companion is a dusty collection of books with browning pages. Think of the surprise when Brad from 8G catches his form tute in the city centre arm in arm with his wife. Sir's in love. It may be the shock that an IT teacher can play sport, or that a French teacher is musical. But the real test of a schoolboy's attitude to the alien life form that he calls teacher is the realisation they fall in love. They are human too. They love and long to be loved. It's not only the poetry-loving English teacher that falls in love. Even the science teacher can fall victim. On Valentine's Day, there's only one thing on everyone's mind. It manifests itself in various ways, but in the end, it's all anyone can think of. Jack is looking forward to going home to his wife. Phil glances across the classroom. Will Rachel be his Valentine? Laura wishes Darren was on leave, and Jane cannot believe she's dumped. Sammy longs to have someone. Rosemary only has her memories and a few photos. It is a part of everyone. We long to love and be loved. The songwriters Bert Karmer and Harry Ruby expose that it's not just some, but everyone says I love you. They write, "Everyone says I love you, the cop on the corner, and the burglar too. The preacher in the pulpit and the man in the pew says, I love you. No matter which side of the law, whether it's in the bank clerk who's locked the safe for the night, or the security guard leaving home, the burglar sneaking in the stillness of twilight, or the lawyer awoken at 5 a.m. to defend a client, everyone says, I love you. The songwriter knows it, and it's this that guarantees his or her success. They are able to put our feelings into words and to music, and we're all suckers for a good ballad. So regardless of our background or our job, we're all affected by a well-written love song. Since we all love, it should be easy to explain why. With a little thought, we recognise that love is universal. There are many ways in which we love, and different types of love. For example, the devotion of a dad to his kids, the closeness of friendship or siblings. But our focus is on romantic love. The trouble begins when we attempt to explain our innate desire for love. It's now taken for granted that we are the products of evolution. It therefore falls to evolution to explain why we love. The basic mechanism of evolution is that strong traits or genes aid survival. And so those with them are more likely to live and breed the next generation. Weak traits are not passed on, because those carrying them do not survive. One way to consider if evolution would support true love would be to consider what part it would play in a rom-com. No genre is a greater advocate for true love. Every rom-com has its respective leading man or woman, and each present with an obstacle that must be overcome. As the viewer, we know that come the end, true love will triumph. An obvious example is the commitment phobe. Attracting the ladies is no problem for Jack. The trouble is, no one can meet his high standards. Nose is too small. Nose is too big. Nose is too perfect. Too tall, too short. Freddy smiles too much, doesn't smile enough. No one is right for Jack. However, as the film continues, it becomes clear the problem is not with the girls, the problem is with Jack. Every reason he has ever given to dump a girlfriend is just a means to hide his fear of commitment. It would take a remarkable woman and a magical chemical bond to snap Jack out of it. The scene has been set. All that is needed is a girl that can cure Jack's phobia. The remainder of the film follows Jack on his journey of realization and his search for the one. True love overcomes the obstacle, and he gets together with his best friend, who's been there for him and bickered with him since the start. How would evolution fit into the rom-com? Would it play a positive role? Thanks to evolution, would true love be found in the end? Or would evolution present as an obstacle to be overcome so true love could flourish? Andrea is a strict evolutionist, and it's time to pass on her superior genes. Yet, they must be complemented by equally exceptional genes. This rom-com is not set in restaurants and festive parties. It's much more clinical The setting is a laboratory. There are no blind dates. Andrea chooses her partner through careful data analysis. She searches for the optimum traits in her child's potential father to ensure her offspring makes a significant contribution to the progress of evolution. Finally, Andrea has reduced it down to 5 candidates. Now it's a simple matter of picking one and having some children. As we watch the film, we find ourselves willing her to come to her senses. And there is some hope. Throughout the film, as Andrea has attended the clinic, she's had a number of awkward encounters with Dave. He works at the clinic and is responsible for security. He's an old romantic, to the extent he really does not fit in at the clinic. But then, he's only a security guard. He's not particularly clever, though he is strong. He needs glasses, but he is tall. Different situations throw Dave and Andrea together, and though you would think a security guard and a client might never meet, they regularly do. Dave teases Andrea and attempts to persuade her on a date. Andrea adamantly turns him down. Yet at the end of the day, when she's alone, in her flat, it's the thought of Dave that lingers. Tempted to take him up on his offer, there's one test she must first make. In a hilarious scene, Andrea makes an excuse to see Dave. Her sole purpose is to collect some of his DNA. Once in her possession, she has it analysed. Dave has Huntington's chorea. Not only will he begin to develop symptoms in his early 40s, but any of his children will have a 50% chance of inheriting the disease. Andrea's mind is made up. She will never see Dave again. But as the weeks pass, all she can think of is Dave. Despite Andrea's better judgment, she cannot get Dave out of her mind. There is no rational explanation. But he makes her laugh. He listens. She enjoys the time they spend together. And then there is that feeling. There's no one quite like Dave. She longs to be with him. Could it be Dave is Andrea's soulmate? Andrea's one. It comes as a surprise that the role that evolution will play in a rom-com is the obstacle love must overcome. Evolution is concerned with passing on the best genes to the next generation, whereas Andrea is willing to compromise this because of Dave. What does it mean? Andrea has fallen in love. It is love that displaced Andrea's commitment to passing on strong genes. Which raises the question, does love have evolutionary advantages? If evolution is the process by which we have developed the response has to be, yes. The problem comes when we attempt to explain why. Is love crucial to ensuring genes are passed on? Is there benefit to the gene pool in commitment and monogamy? Whilst Andrea and Dave faff about, Jack has been sleeping with all the girls he has discarded and has fathered multiple, similarly lustful offspring. Maybe lust is the answer we're looking for. Surely this would be much more expedient to evolution. lust promotes promiscuity, which provides more opportunity for the dispersal of strong genes and increases the probability that beneficial genes will be passed on. However, if lust is such a beneficial characteristic, we would expect it to be a primary trait found exclusively in every generation. Surely it would completely eclipse any tendency towards exclusive relationships. Looking at a society, perhaps the promiscuous gene is prevalent. There are plenty who have explored having multiple lovers, and it's almost the norm for many in early adult life. This, of course, fits with evolution. And maybe it's our experimentation with monogamy that is just a glitch. But promiscuity may be fun, or an attempt to gain experience, or understand oneself, but we still dream of finding the one. Jack, in our example, betrayed his psychological turmoil. Ultimately, meaningless relationships leave us feeling empty and craving real love. There are those that try to combine the two and form open relationships. Though committed to a relationship with one another, each partner can explore sexual relationships with others without shame or guilt. In the song The Night of the 4th of May, Al Stewart describes his open relationship. He writes, "Don't ask about tomorrow. Give what you have. Take what you need. Your time is only now. Don't try to tie me down to promises. I live for today. Today is all there is. And freedom seems everything to me." Freedom and not love is the overriding principle. The open relationship is convenient for the minute, and it provides an opportunity for exploration. No one should get comfortable. There's no suggestion that the relationship will last. On the fateful night, when they put their ideas into reality, the two lovers tempt and tease one another to go home with someone else. They each do. But when it comes to the crunch, Stuart leaves before anything really happens. However, when he arrives home, he realises his girlfriend has not shown the same restraint. He puts it, "And though I'd always told myself that when our time ended, I'd walk away with no regrets and no attempts to stay, somehow it didn't seem to be that way. I find I'm needing every word you say." His discovery has hurt. He thought he could be indifferent. Stuart's forecast was wrong. Freedom is no longer everything. He depends on her. Though the songwriter desired the freedom of an open relationship, he realizes he was wrong. The song becomes a lament over the end of a relationship. He thought he would be able to simply walk away. Instead, he's heartbroken. While we experiment with open relationships or promiscuity, in the end we betray our desire for exclusive love. Lust does appear to be more beneficial to evolution than love. Yet here we are, and our true desire is to love and be loved. It is possible to take the argument one step further. Before the evolutionists can explain why we love, they first need to address the problem of impersonal and personal entities. We've all heard the question, which came first, the chicken or the egg? But the pertinent question here is, which came first, the rabbit or the warren? This question shares none of the paradox of the first. The answer is clear to all. The rabbit comes first and is responsible for burrowing the warren. Why am I going on about rabbits and chickens? Well, the question highlights the distinction between what is personal and impersonal. To be personal is to have the potential to relate to another personal being in a dynamic relationship. The rabbit has relationships with other rabbits. Granted, it's not as sophisticated as the relationship between humans, but nevertheless, they communicate to one another and recognise those who belong to their kin. They demonstrate care for one another. When they provide food for their family and are quick to protect their baby rabbits from a predator. In contrast, the rabbit warren is impersonal. Not only is it inanimate and so restricted to its spot, but it does not have the means to communicate with other rabbit warrens. The rabbit warren is made up of impersonal rocks, impersonal soil, and itself is an impersonal void. The rabbit is not personal because he or she is born in the rabbit warren. The impersonal can never create the personal. The reason the rabbit is personal is because she was given life by her rabbit parents. Only a rabbit who relates to other rabbits can bring into being a personal rabbit. Only the personal can be responsible for the personal coming into being. Yet, evolution assumes that there was an occasion when the impersonal produces the personal. At some point in the process of evolution, an early impersonal event has to produce the first personal being. If the world began with a big bang, then the starting point is impersonal. At a point in time, this impersonal energy and matter has to somehow become personal. Consciousness is still a great mystery to the scientist. But once it's decided that we are species that have evolved, and that we have a complex consciousness, the evolutionist simply asserts, this is because our brain is so big. Edwards O. Wilson writes, to play the game the human way, it was necessary for the evolving populations to acquire an ever higher degree of intelligence. They had to feel empathy for others, to measure the emotions of friends and enemy alike, to judge the intentions of all of them, and to plan a strategy for personal social interactions. As a result, the human brain became simultaneously highly intelligent and intensely social. He had to build mental scenarios and far into the future to imagine the consequences of every relationship. Ruling on the alternative plans of action were the amygdala and other emotion-controlling centres of the brain and autonomic nervous system. Is this intended to be an explanation or a description? The observation Wilson makes is accurate. What distinguishes humans from other mammals is a higher degree of dynamic relationship. Wilson describes this well. Humans have great advantages precisely because they anticipate how people will respond. This enables us to consider options, weigh them up and dismiss them in order to develop a superior response. However, at best, Wilson is describing what we do, and how what we do is personal. But he fails to give an explanation for how we developed our empathy and emotions in the first place. Like the rabbit, the human who is personal is so because he or she comes from parents who are personal. Our empathy and emotions are present because we are products of personal beings. How does an impersonal explosion lead to a personal world? The onus remains on the evolutionist to explain how the personal has evolved from the impersonal. Biologists may describe the benefits of consciousness, but they do not explain the pivotal point when the impersonal became personal. Evolution has little to say about love. It cannot explain why we are personal. Survival of the fittest and gene propagation are inherently brutal. So what is the next move? Is the next move God? No. There's a problem. Before God created the world, there was nothing. There was no one. God was alone. He had no one to relate to, no one to speak to, no one to listen to, no one he could treat with fairness, no one's company he could enjoy. In short, if God was alone, God had no one to love. In the last stanza of the poem, I Envy Not in Any Moods, Alfred Lord Tennyson writes, I hold it true, whate'er befall, I feel it when I sorrow most. 'Tis better to have loved and lost than never to have loved at all. Why does Tennyson write, 'tis better to have loved and lost than never to have loved at all? To have lost love infers you've known love and experienced another's love. But if you've never loved, the knowledge of love escapes you. While Tennyson is describing our human experience, it helps us to consider what it would be like for a God who has never loved. Religions such as Islam believe that God is one. Before God created the world, there was no one but Him. God was alone. Eternity spent isolated with no relationships and no community. No love to give and no one to reciprocate. A God who is alone is a God who has never loved. God can only create a world and include in it what he knows. If he has never loved another, then he does not know what love is like, and he is unable to create a world that loves. One thing we notice about our creativity as humans is we too are restricted by what we know. Songwriters attribute their lyrics to past experience. A relationship that ended in heartbreak. One that was too short. The unrequited love. Or the one that was forever. Monsters in films are always inspired by real creatures, and aliens have recognisable anatomy. Every alien has some means of movement. They have some sort of limb to allow them to lift. And they have light receptors that carry out the same task as eyes. they communicate because we communicate. Ultimately, they have the same sense as we have. It's merely their skin colour, voice and language that differ. This is because we are confined to what we know, and our imagination never creates anything that's truly unique. To create is to make what we know. God, though at a much higher level, creates according to what he knows. This may seem like a restriction to God, but it's not. God will only work within the confines of his own nature and create that which he knows. Everything he knows completely. And he creates his world to reflect his knowledge. The explanation for love can only be found in the God who knows what love is, the God who experiences love and is in a relationship. Only a God who has loved can create creatures that love one another. We may be familiar with the phrase God the Father, God the Son, and God the Holy Spirit. It describes the God who is Trinity. He is three in one. The three refers to the Father, Son, and Spirit. The one refers to the one God. The God who is Trinity is able to be one while being three. Many people find the very idea of God being both three and one a stumbling block. When considered from a mathematical point of view, obviously, something is either three or one, and cannot be both at the same time. However, the Trinity is not a mathematical problem. Instead, we should understand that God is one, united in purpose and intent, being of one mind and will. There is one God, and he is united. Yet, within the confines of the Godhead, he is three persons. Each is a distinct person. The Father is Father and not the Son or the Spirit. The Son is Son and not Father or Spirit. And the Spirit is Spirit and not Father or Son. Since God is Trinity, before God created the world, within his own being, the Father was in a relationship with the Son and Spirit. And the Son and Spirit were in a relationship with one another. The Father had two others whom he could speak to and listen to, whom he could enjoy the company of, and whom he could love faithfully. The Father not only loves the other persons of the Trinity, but is also loved back. The Son and Spirit both love the Father, and for that matter, love one another. So, when God creates the world, he already knows love. The Trinity knows how to communicate because each person of the Trinity engages with the others. The God who is Trinity knows what it is to enjoy relationships. Furthermore, the Father is not just in a relationship with one other, but he's in a community because there are three members in the Trinity. As the third person of the Trinity, the Spirit plays a crucial role in assuring that the relationship between the Father and Son does not become insular. In human relationships, it's considered an embarrassment to be the third person. Inevitably, you're labelled the gooseberry. It is well known that two is company and three is a crowd. However, we also know the importance of couples having relationships with others outside of the boyfriend-girlfriend or husband-and-wife relationship. If we become isolated from other relationships, our primary relationship collapses under its own strain. Unsurprisingly, experience proves this is true. We may have seen the damage done by a possessive boyfriend. As far as John is concerned, he is all Anna needs. There's nothing he would not do for her, and anyone else would just get in their way. However, when Anna is no longer allowed to meet her friends and can only spend time with John, something happens to the relationship. It ceases to be genuine. Or take the bullying husband of a devoted wife. In the absence of others, his benevolence has turned to teasing, which has become cruel and belittling. There was no one to raise an eyebrow, or gasp in horror, or have a quiet word. Living in community improves our love for one another and safeguards our relationships, allowing them to thrive. These are illustrations taken from human relationships. The Trinity is the perfect relationship on which our relationships are based. The Spirit is the third person in relationship with the Father and Son, and his role ensures that the Father and Son are in community. In doing so, the Spirit authenticates a relationship between the Father and Son. The Father and Son's relationship is a genuine because their love is shared by a third person. Their love for one another will not get swallowed up because they're in community. For God to create a world that knows what it is to love and be loved, he himself must know what love is. He does, because he's Trinity. So when he creates us, he makes us like him. He gives his creatures both a desire and ability to love and be loved. The Father's relationship with the Son is not just convenient, but it is intrinsic to who God is. To know God as Father is to know him as the Son's Father. He defines himself upon his relationship with his Son. He relies upon the Son's relationship in order to be the Father. If the Father loses his Son, the Father loses his identity. He ceases to be the very thing that most defines his person. The Father does not reduce himself to an individual, but identifies himself as relational. He names himself Father of the Son. The same can be said of the Son. He does not insist, I am a person in my own right. Rather, his identity is intrinsically caught up in being the Father's Son. The Father and Son are each defined by their relationship with the other. If their relationship was to come to an end, they would both lose their identity. This is enlightening for us and who we are. We long to love and be loved, but we live in a society that celebrates independence. We resent it when we are identified in relation to someone else as Max's wife or Christine's husband, Justine's son, or Emily's friend. We seek our identity in our achievements, vocations, or experiences. Yet, what truly makes us unique is our relationships with others. We do not fully forfeit our desire for relationships for the sake of our own independence. Instead, we betray that we do indeed reflect the character of the God who's given us life. Just as relationships are intrinsic to who God is, so relationships are intrinsic to who we are. God is not only the explanation for why we desire to love and be loved, but God also provides the explanation for why we specifically desire exclusive relationships. In contrast to evolution, where promiscuity would be beneficial. We desire relationships of faithfulness. This means that we become angry when someone demonstrates an interest in our spouse, or we become suspicious when our spouse is regularly late home and makes excuses to be away. When we discover we're being cheated on, we do not send them on their way with well wishes. Instead, we stand and fight for our relationship. If we do not, it is not love we demonstrate, but indifference. The jealousy of a possessive boyfriend is ugly. His demands upon his girlfriend are relentless. He must know where she is and whom she's with. When she fails to text, he's phoning her to find out what is wrong. There's no let-up, even when they're together. Every text received must be explained. Too long spent on Facebook is suspicious. Everything is interpreted as an act of betrayal. It's no wonder jealousy has a bad reputation. However, there is a place for jealousy. It is not always a bad emotion. Sometimes flirting with others is a test, an attempt to provoke the indifferent boyfriend to action. Upon discovering a partner has been having an affair, the wrong response is to shrug and reach for the TV remote. If she feared there was no love, the absence of jealousy is proof she was right. Given the role appropriate jealousy plays in our relationships, it's no surprise that we are reflecting an appropriate jealousy that comes from God. In the Bible, God describes himself as jealous, because if he was not, he would be indifferent. When a relationship has been threatened, the appropriate response is jealousy. And God is keen, we know he is jealous. He wants us to know what he is like. His love for us is significant, so he doesn't just shrug when we turn away. He is jealous. This is why God describes his relationship with his people as the faithful husband and his adulterous wife, respectively. It is striking imagery. God is explaining that as the husband's commitment to his wife is exclusive, so is the expectation of his relationship with his people. But throughout their history, as recorded in the Old Testament and the Bible, God's people have continually sought out other gods to worship. The language becomes quite graphic. The people are like a wife who leaves her husband to take up prostitution, but refuses to accept any cash. How should God respond? We would not expect indifference. God's reputation is in tatters. Everyone who hears the news would laugh. But this is not the only reason God is jealous. Though his people are small and insignificant, God has chosen them. And despite their betrayal, he loves them. His response is fixed. God will remain their husband. God is faithful to his people even while they worship idols. Though the people attribute their possessions as gifts from their idols, in reality it is God who looks after them. When the people are desperate and finally cry out to God, he is faithful, despite their unfaithfulness. God is described as the husband who buys back his wife from her pimp. The relationship between God the husband and his wife the people illustrates that God remains faithful. It is to be an exclusive relationship, and it explains why we desire faithfulness and exclusivity in our relationships. We reflect the character of the God who is faithful, though we often forfeit it because relationships are difficult. Ultimately, we want to be faithful to those we love. It is hard to see how the desire to love and be loved within the confines of an exclusive relationship, can develop from evolution. The mechanism of evolution depends upon beneficial genes being passed on to future generations. It's more likely that evolution would lead to a prolific promiscuity, since it is the basic trait that is required to ensure genes are passed on. Yet, experience proves we desire to love and be loved. It's not something we learn from pop culture, rather the abundance of love songs and rom-coms and their popularity support the case that inherent in every one of us is the desire for relationship. We desire more than just strong genes for our children. We want them to be in faithful, loving relationships. The only explanation for our desire is that we are personal beings because we reflect our Creator, who is personal. This is because we are personal beings made to reflect our personal Creator, who has created us to love because He knows what love is. Reflection. Made to be like Him. Chapter 2. Suffering. In Star Wars 3, Revenge of the Sith, Anakin Skywalker has a premonition that his wife, Padme Amidala, will die in childbirth. He seeks advice from Master Yoda. And this is Yoda's response. Death is a natural part of life. Rejoice for those around you who transform into the Force. Warn them, do not. Miss them, do not. Attachment leads to jealousy. The shadow of greed, that is. Train yourself to let go of everything you fear to lose. Since we know Anakin's fate, he becomes Darth Vader. We see the wisdom of Yoda's advice. Anakin fears the loss of Padme, and Senator Palpatine preys on his fear. Palpatine promises he can teach Anakin how to save Padme, but Anakin must first join the dark side. While Yoda's advice makes sense in the context of the film, is it plausible to think we can train ourselves to become impervious to suffering? The ancient Stoics thought it was possible. The Stoics believed the virtue of man depended upon his behaviour and had nothing to do with his wealth or standing in society. If a man lived a good or bad life, it had no impact on suffering. Both the good and bad could become ill. Both could lose a family member. Both suffered. Since little could be done to avoid pain, when the Stoic experienced trials, there was no profit in allowing it to affect him. Like the Jedi, the Stoic's aim was to react to suffering with nonchalance. Could they achieve such indifference? Hypothetically, this may seem possible. But when the Stoic lost his son, would he continue with life unaffected by grief or sense of loss? It seems unlikely, but maybe it is possible to condition our mind to minimise the physical side of suffering. Hypnobirthing is a technique used to manage labour pains. Through various strategies, including relaxation, meditation, and visualization, fear and tension can be managed. Yet despite the carefully prepared music, candles, birthing pool, and breathing through the pain, each contraction still hurts. Furthermore, suffering is not just physical. Afterwards, as Martha lay awake on the maternity ward, her hand resting on the remaining bump, she longed to feel a kick. Tears streamed down to her pillow, and every baby's cry was a reminder that her baby was gone. It's very hard to know how a mother could possibly learn indifference to the loss of her child. We cannot detach our emotions from who we are. Instead of suppressing our feelings, they encompass our every thought. Sleep may bring some reprieve, but it either escapes us or the suffering bleeds into nightmares. We may be distracted or comforted for a short time, but nothing really takes our mind away. All our attention is caught up in the pain. Personal suffering, be it physical or emotional, is immediate, all-encompassing, and cannot be ignored. The Stoics were wrong. Humans are affected by emotions, and we cannot detach ourselves from them. We cannot rationalize away our tears. Our emotions are even affected by fiction. Whether we've seen Bambi or not, everyone recognizes one of the saddest moments in film history is when his mum is killed. We know Bambi's mum is a character dreamt up for a book. We realise that her life on the big screen is an illusion created by filming consecutive pictures at a particular rate of frames per second. However, when it dawns on us that she is dead, we catch a breath, may even shed a tear. It's impossible to be indifferent to suffering. To humanity's credit, when catastrophe strikes, we unite to bring relief. When a bomb explodes at the finishing line of a marathon, competitors give blood at Red Cross tents, while bystanders tear their own clothes to use as temporary tourniquets. The response to the deadliest natural disaster in recorded history is the world's largest emergency aid program. When some suffer, others act. We respond to suffering with the same force it inflicts upon us. We are all agreed. Suffering is not good. It is an imposter in our world. The assertion that suffering is wrong is not an absolute. There are some occasions when suffering has a role to play. Suffering can act as a warning. Consider the child who suffers with abdominal pains. The pain is unbearable, and her parents will do everything within their power to bring an end to the suffering. When the doctor diagnoses appendicitis, everyone is relieved. The pain, though unpleasant, signal to the parents that all was not well. The severity of the pain ensured that medical treatment was sought. Thanks to the urgency, the diagnosis was ascertained, and surgery was carried out before the appendix burst. The pain played a positive role. As we grow up, our parents or guardians discipline us. At the time, we feel like we're being hard done by. As we lament, we believe that our suffering is incomparable. As we become older, there's a chance we learn to appreciate why our parents did what they did. Then, when we become parents ourselves, we realise that discipline is a necessary part of raising children. In the next chapter, we will be exploring the topic of justice. When a defendant is found guilty, he or she will be punished. For the more serious crimes, this will involve prison. Inevitably, this will lead to suffering for the inmate as well for his or her family. On this occasion, the suffering is considered appropriate in proportion to the severity of the crime. The penalty also serves to prevent others from committing a similar crime. There's also the possibility that the time in prison can rehabilitate the prisoner. Suffering is complex, and it's too simplistic to say all suffering is wrong. However, despite the fact that suffering has a role to play in certain circumstances, it does not undermine our feeling that, generally, suffering is wrong. When an atheist provides a reason why there's no God, at some point the argument inevitably turns towards suffering. The claim, there cannot be a loving God while suffering is in the world. If there was a God, he would stop the suffering. Since pain does exist, then God does not. However, the atheist is a little ahead of themselves. In order to ask the question, why does God allow suffering? He or she must have first made the assumption that suffering is bad. But why? Whether we recognise it or not, we all hold a worldview. A worldview is our attempt to understand and make sense of the world in which we live. But can our worldview explain why we believe suffering is wrong? Some people believe the world began with a big bang. But can the belief that suffering is right or wrong come about through a process that begins with a big explosion? Impersonal particles join together to form what will eventually become us. Why does one arrangement of atoms, made up of protons, neutrons and electrons, arrange itself in a final product that can laugh, while another arrangement of the same particles is impersonal and cannot laugh? Why is a rock utterly impervious to being split in half, whereas a person who's lost a leg suffers both physically and mentally? If the world is nothing more than a mechanical process, then suffering is simply one part of the system. Surely the only logical response to suffering is stoic-like indifference. One aspect of existence we label suffering, while another aspect, the process by which a plant makes food from light, we label photosynthesis. Suffering is just another part of the remnant of the explosion. Neither can be right, nor can they be wrong. It just is. Can karma explain why we suffer? While karma originates from ancient India, it has been adopted at a popular level by Western society. Karma distinguishes between good and evil. A good act is rewarded, whereas an evil act is punished. What would such a punishment look like? Suffering? Regardless of whether the evil act was from this life or a previous one, the evil explains the suffering now. The problem arises when we reflect on how karma achieves this. Karma depends upon being able to distinguish between right and wrong. Only once the distinction is made can the good be rewarded and the wicked punished. Fate is, in some ways, a similar concept to karma. In the popular drama Game of Thrones, guilt is determined by fate. Catelyn Stark accuses Tyrion Lannister of attempted murder, but rather than a trial by jury, his guilt is to be determined through trial by combat. Two warriors fight. One represents the defendant, the other the prosecutor. The fight is to the death. If the defendant's warrior dies, he or she is guilty. If the warrior representing the prosecutor is killed, then the accusation must have been false. Fate determines who is right and who is wrong. Fate decides between good and evil. But how can we trust the outcome? Surely, the bigger, stronger, smarter warrior wins regardless of the innocence or otherwise of the man he represents. Hollywood may have a philosophy of good triumphing over evil, but reality is not that tidy. Who or what is fate? On what grounds can we believe it will make the right decision? Before we reach for our dueling pistols, we should consider the question of what fate is. Fate is a way of referring to what happens, often when events are out of our control. But fate has no identity, no credentials, and no assurances. It is unable to distinguish between a good person and their kind act, from a bad person and their wicked act. Consider gravity as an example. It too is an impersonal force. Gravity acts upon both the good and bad indiscriminately. If a bad person is on the verge of a cliff and they topple forward, gravity will do the rest. When a good person stands too close and peers too far, gravity will not push them to safety. Gravity cannot evaluate if one person is bad and another is good, because it is an impersonal force. Karma and fate are no more able to differentiate between good and evil than gravity can. Ultimately, neither karma nor fate is able to help us understand why suffering is wrong. Could it be we think suffering is wrong because we simply know? Although karma and fate are unable to distinguish between right and wrong, we can. We are personal beings and can evaluate issues of morality for ourselves. However, it only takes a moment's reflection to conclude our moral compass is flawed. Gary is middle-aged. Years ago he gave in to every whim, but now as he looks back he does not have happy memories. Despite all the women, he was lonely, and his insistence that he would not settle down hurt many of his partners. He borrowed a lot of money and spent it all on holidays. Saving for the future meant missing out now. At the time he felt great. He would have said that he was making the right choices. Now, he thinks he was wrong. Gary's opinion on what constitutes right and wrong changed over time. Behaviour that he thought would not hurt others, he now recognises did cause suffering. It is not only on an individual level that our perception of right and wrong changes over time. The consensus also changes at a societal level. In the past, abortion was illegal. Now it is not. On Tuesday, the 31st of January 2017, 50,000 gay men were posthumously pardoned. What once led to a prison sentence is now a celebrated part of family life. On 13th of August 1964, Gwyn Evans and Peter Allen were the last people in the United Kingdom to be executed. Over time, opinion changed. Capital punishment was accepted, but now the death sentence is deemed to be wrong. This all suggests our moral compass is, at best, fluid. Our views mature. Opinions develop because we understand more. Sometimes we change our mind. We believe we're making progress. But what guarantee do we have that this is true? Our ability to decide what is right and wrong is impaired. We weep and writhe in the face of immense suffering on our planet. But we do not have the authority or understanding to explain our deep-seated knowledge that suffering is wrong. For that, we have to look elsewhere. The adage, like father, like son, reflects that we resemble those who've given us life and raised us. Like it or not, we are like our parents. It can be embarrassing being a parent of a toddler, since they reflect your behaviour back at you. Your son pouts when he's in deep concentration. Where does that mannerism come from? Weeks of watching and carefully studying your spouse leave you without an answer. Until one night, when scrutinising a broken toy, there's a moment of realisation. You pout when you concentrate. As children grow older, they begin to spot characteristics they share with their parents. It is what makes watching a home video so cringeworthy. Everything from the way we walk and the way we stand to the tone of our voice carry the hallmarks of where we came from. I cannot remember how many times I answered the landline as a teenager, only to be mistaken for my dad. Many of our mannerisms come from our parents. The Bible explains God has created us. He is the creator, and we are his creatures. God has given us life, and because of this we reflect his character. Before we explore how we reflect God's character, we must first appreciate that some attributes cannot pass from the creator to the creature. For example, God is eternal. He has no beginning and can have no end. In contrast, even if we are given eternal life, we all have a birth and therefore a beginning. We will never be eternal in the way God is. Another characteristic of God is that he is omniscient, which means he has a comprehensive understanding of everything. This is another characteristic that God cannot pass to us creatures. We lack the capacity to understand everything exhaustively, which explains why we struggle to get 100% on a pub quiz. However, God has given us the ability to know, and since God has always known everything, then what we know now, God knew first. Knowledge is something we get from our Creator. We also have other characteristics that reflect the one who gave us life. We become angry when the innocent suffer. We are keen to put wrong right. If we find a good cause, we help. These attributes we have because we are like our Creator. The Bible explains how God has created everything without exception. Since God is the source of everything, he has knowledge of it all at its most intricate level. He knows how everything works at a macro level, and he understands the mechanics at the micro level. God knows every species of birds, and he understands how each one of them flies. He knows when the sparrow falls, the blackbird's beak is broken, or the robin lays an egg. He knows how their organs work and understands every different cell that is needed to make each muscle twitch and feather grow. He knows every proton, neutron and electron that comprises each atom and enables every interaction for growth, energy and breath. God knows his creation exhaustively, and nothing escapes him. In the case of a human inventor, there's always an element of serendipity, or the discovery that something works, without really appreciating why something works. This cannot be said of God. Everything that God has created is created according to his will. This means there is intent and purpose behind everything that is part of his creation. In order to be able to guarantee that everything acts according to his purpose, and to ensure his purpose cannot be compromised, he must do better than the human inventor. He cannot depend on knowing that something works. He must understand intricately why it works. A creation, nothing appeared by accident. Rather, everything was made for a purpose. The result is God knows his creation completely. No aspect of it takes him by surprise. He put it in its place. There is nothing he seeks out in order to understand it better. As creator, he knows everything intricately. God's perfect knowledge is not limited to his creation. He also has perfect knowledge of himself. Here is another example of how we are at the same time similar to God, yet different. We have outlined how we know ourselves, but our knowledge changes and is limited. God's knowledge of himself is different. He's not learning more about himself over time. He does not make mistakes through which he learns more. He already knows everything he could possibly know about himself. Since God has exhaustive knowledge about his creation and his own character, he has the unique vantage point to determine what is right and what is wrong. What he concludes is in line with his perfect character. He will not learn something at a later point that will alter his opinion. He will not be disorientated when presented with counter-arguments. Instead, what he decides is true because he has all the knowledge needed to make the right decision. We believe suffering is wrong. We also recognize that suffering can act as a warning that discipline is necessary when raising children, and that the state's role includes punishing the criminal. God has created us to live in the world he has made. He determines what is right and what is wrong, and our feelings of right and wrong reflect that fact that we have been created by him to live in his world. We considered in chapter 1 that God is personal and has been in an eternal relationship. Having created us personal, we are able to have a relationship with him. In this chapter, we can add that since God is personal, he can bestow his characteristics to us, and he passes knowledge of himself and his world to us. What we know because we're like God. It is only the personal that can distinguish between right and wrong, and then communicate that knowledge to other personal beings. Suffering is often the atheist's trump card against God. Why would a loving God allow such pain? Here we have explored the grounds on which an atheist or anyone else can make the assertion that suffering is wrong, and there is only one response. The reason we feel that suffering is wrong is because God determines what is right and wrong, and we are made to be like him. Reflection. Made to be like him. Chapter 3. Justice. The judge slumped into his leather armchair. The ice chinked as he swirled his whiskey. His eyes fell on the thick, creamy-coloured envelope with its royal crest. An invitation to Buckingham Palace. He was to receive an OBE in recognition of his work, his integrity, his reputation for fairness, his wisdom, and his contribution to certain high-profile cases. He felt tired. At the start of his career, he had been determined to obtain justice. Instead, it had often been frustrated. Some cases were indisputable. He knew the defendant was guilty. The prosecution provided sufficient evidence to support a guilty verdict. The response from the defence had been admirable and appropriate, but everyone knew there could only be one outcome. The jury did not take long to deliberate, and the defendant was rightly convicted. The more problematic cases would impinge on the judge's sleep. No honest judge wants to send an innocent man to jail. No genuine judge knowingly would. Such cases would persist in his thoughts, but a judge must base his sentence on evidence, not on unexplained disquiet. On other occasions, if the prosecution's case collapsed due to inadequate evidence, there'd be turbulence in the media. There was no doubt of the guilt of the defendant, but because of ambiguity in the law, a guilty man went free. The judge's wife comforted him the only way she knew how. You did your best. She's right. But they both know. Her husband has significant limitations. The judge is limited in two ways. In his knowledge and in his power. Before a sentence is passed, he needs information. As humans, we're limited in our knowledge, so testimony and evidence are presented before the judge. If the evidence is incomplete, or a testimony is inaccurate, the guilty go free. But what if the judge had no need to rely upon the knowledge of others and knew everything? Then his justice would be flawless. The judge would have all the information he could possibly need for every trial. But this is ridiculous. To know everything would suggest he could experience everything. He'd need to transcend both time and space. The only possible solution is a comprehensive video and audio surveillance system. And it would need to record every word spoken, every act done without exception. No oversight will be acceptable since nobody knows who will commit a crime or where it will take place. CCTV on every street, in every room of every building, cars with inbuilt bugs, every item of clothing able to record voices. Clearly, this is unrealistic and would lead to public outcry. Not only is the judge's knowledge limited, but so too is his power. His authority to see justice done is heavily restricted. Justice is sidelined every time charges are dropped in exchange for testimony, or a crime is simply discovered once it's too late. There is little doubt that Jimmy Savile was guilty of the multiple allegations made against him, but which judge has the power to bring the dead to justice? Though the judge desires to bring justice, he can only do so within his limitations, since his knowledge and power are not complete. His ability to bring justice to victims is inevitably impaired. It is not only those who work in the judicial system who are concerned for justice. The desire for justice and fairness is found in us all. No one teaches us to appeal, that's not fair, when our big brother takes our toy car, or when we refuse to eat our vegetables and are not allowed pudding, or we cannot go to a party because auntie's coming for tea, or we do not get a turn on the playground ride. How do we explain our desire for justice? Giving an answer is not easy. The problem is acknowledged by the evolution theorist. As we've seen before, evolution depends on the traits we exhibit being beneficial for our survival. If a characteristic favours survival, it will make it to the next generation. If an aspect of our behaviour compromises our survival, that characteristic will be lost. If we consider it from the evolution theorist position, we find ourselves in a phase of evolution that is extremely complex. Society is multi-layered. Everyone plays their role in maintaining the equilibrium. We're not in small isolated tribes, but a sophisticated interacting world. We can consider the world at the level of the local council, a nation's government, or international powers. Within these layers, we have developed health systems, educational systems, economies, and legal systems. We all contribute positively or negatively, but how do we get here? The onus is on the evolutionist to explain why these elements are beneficial to our survival. It is easy to consider how we benefit now. Because we live in large communities, we can choose different roles. Not everyone is required to grow food in order to feed his or her family. Rather, the farmer grows food on an industrial level and sells his or her produce. Even then, it does not go direct to the kitchen table. Food grown by the farmers must first be prepared, whether it's carved by a butcher, baked into bread, or packaged as a ready-to-eat salad. It's only once it's in the supermarket that we purchase it. Since we are freed from hunting and gathering, our purpose is to earn money to pay for food. This complex society enables us to pursue other roles without endangering our survival. This includes anything from research into medicine, teaching children, travelling to space, to governing the country. One of the most lucrative areas is the entertainment business. A society as diverse and complex as this relies on justice. The security guard deters the shoplifter. Police investigate an assault. A forensic scientist analyses DNA data. The lawyer makes his case. The judge presides over the trial. And snatched from their daily affairs are the jurors who listen and give a verdict. They all contribute to make our society safe, just and fair. The alternative will be anarchy. Laws make life manageable, understandable, and dependable. But surely it goes deeper than that. While it is easy to observe the benefits of justice in contemporary society, it's much harder to explain how the characteristic of fairness proved beneficial in the early stages of evolution. The problem is, administering justice is costly. Imagine a group made of six cavemen. Two are keen that everyone gets their share. Two others have the selfish gene and see no issue with putting their survival above everybody else's. The final two do not present with either the fairness or selfish gene. All six collect food necessary for survival. Over a period of time, it becomes evident that someone has been stealing food. The small amount of surplus which is gathered for scarcer months is gone. The two with the fairness gene are determined to find the culprits, but they forfeit time they could have spent hunting for food and sleeping in their investigations. The two with selfish genes show no interest in finding the culprit. They remain both well-fed and well-rested. The reason they do not investigate the crime is because they already know who is guilty. They stole the food. They enjoy their spoils and take advantage of the two who do not present with either gene. They reduce their efforts while still eating an equal portion of the day's findings, each day growing stronger and healthier than the others. There is all likelihood that the two who are busy seeking justice will get tired, hungry, compromise their survival and die, therefore failing to pass on their disposition for fairness, while those with the selfish gene flourish. The illustration makes the point that's already been made by Dennis L. Krebs, who is an evolutionist. He writes, "Accounting for the evolution of dispositions to punish third parties is tricky, because if we assume that it is costly to inflict punishments, those who refuse to accept responsibility for administering punishments would fare better than those who accepted responsibility. The principle of justice appears to be at odds with the mantra of evolution, survival of the fittest. Intrinsically means the death of the weak. Those that have strong genes will pass their desirable characteristics to the next generation and grow stronger still. Any undesirable characteristics will be lost because the weak host is disadvantaged. In contrast, justice does not accept that the strong should thrive at the expense of the weak. Instead, justice provides a voice for the weak, listening to the oppressed and fighting their cause. Justice defends the weak so that they have an equal chance of survival. Justice stands in direct opposition to the driving force of evolution. Is it all that important? We might be inclined to think that now we have sophisticated societies, justice has its part to play, but in early phases of evolution it was not required. It appears to be beneficial now, but that could all change. If in the future justice ceases to be advantageous, it will once again be lost. But our concern for justice does not suggest that this is true. The judge is not alone in his distress over the absence of justice. The public demonstrate passionate indignation when a man's unpunished crimes are revealed. There is universal emotion when justice is evaded. We should be able to explain our desire for justice. How do we account for this rage against injustice? If evolution struggles to explain why the cry, "That's not fair," is automatic to all of us, then why are we like this? The Bible talks about how we're made in the image of our Creator. That is not to say we look like God, but rather it refers to what we are like and how we behave. We are made to behave like our Creator so that we reflect His character. In previous chapters, we've seen He's personal, and so we are made for relationships. So too, as He is just, we are concerned for justice. To explore this in a little more detail, imagine a world without crime. We might think justice is no longer necessary, because if there are no crimes, then no one will be taken to court. But that does not mean there is no justice. What it means is everyone is behaving justly towards one another. Justice is played out. There's no need to appeal to a legal system because people are acting with fairness to each other. In order to behave with fairness, we would need to be completely focused on other people. Our concern would be always for the benefit of others. In turn, their concern would be for us. There would never be any need to cry, "It's not fair." Clearly, this is not the world we live in, but it is a picture of the relationship that the Father, Son, and Spirit have among one another. Their justice does not require a court of law. Within their relationship, they always put the other's concern above their own. Within their relationship, they enjoy complete justice because they do not harbour any selfishness. So, what is going on? Like the judge at the beginning, we are discouraged when we see injustice, and like the judge, we are limited by knowledge and power. Human justice systems will always be imperfect. Our concern for fairness is compounded when we add all the small injustices we experience day to day. The driver who speeds ahead in the empty lane, only to cut in at the last moment and jump the traffic. Waiting and watching as everyone who arrived later is given their meals first. Feeling hard done by when you've been overlooked for promotion because no one is present when you shine. We find ourselves concerned for fairness, but live in a world where fairness prevails only a small proportion of the time. The rest of the time, life is not fair. God's justice does not share our limitations. The Creator is not limited by knowledge or power. God has all knowledge at His disposal because He's the Creator and He knows His world exhaustively. As Creator, He transcends space and time. He's not confined to one place or time period. He sees everything that takes place firsthand. He doesn't rely upon testimony and evidence when it comes to carrying out His role as judge. He knows precisely what has been done. He knows every thought, understands the motive behind every action, and remembers every detail. Everything is seen and understood in its context. He has all that is required to make the right decision. God may have all the information required to make the correct judgment, but does He have the power and authority to guarantee justice is done? It's precisely when God's power is considered that many people become uneasy. If God is all-powerful, then He must be a tyrant. Does God's sovereignty necessarily mean He is a dictator? A ruler has total control, and nothing and no one to constrain him. During times of prosperity and peace, there's no need for constraint. The sovereign and the people who serve him are happy. However, when resources become low and rationing is necessary, the tyrant will not forego his privileges for the sake of his subjects. Since the dictator is answerable to no one, the people starve so he can maintain the opulence he's become accustomed to. Thankfully, the reigns of human dictators eventually come to an end. They all eventually die. This cannot be said of God. The human is only without constraint while his rule lasts. However, the very nature of God infers there will be no end to his rule. There is no external force that can thwart God's plan. If God is a tyrant, he could be the worst kind. Yet, we may have the wrong idea. Just because total power corrupts the human dictator, it does not mean the same applies to God. God is all-powerful, and there is nothing external to him that has the potential to restrict his power. Nevertheless, God will never become corrupt, for the simple reason that his own character constrains him. God cannot contradict his own character. A God who is all-powerful poses a serious threat, but when the all-powerful God is all-wise, and his power is always qualified by his wisdom, then when he acts with power, his actions will always be wholly right. But wisdom is only one attribute that qualifies his power. His immense power is also guided by his goodness. He is the benevolent creator who acts always for the best interests of his creation. Neither is it only God's wisdom and goodness that governs God's power. We can add to it all his characteristics, among them his love, holiness, compassion, mercy, faithfulness and perfection. God will never use his power in a way that would contradict any of these other characteristics, but rather they ensure his power is impeccable. Not only do all God's attributes qualify his power, but his power qualifies every attribute. If he knows what is good, he needs to have the power to bring about the good. If he keeps his promises, he must have the power to ensure each promise is kept. And he can only truly be just if he has the power to apply his justice. Otherwise, his justice is merely theoretical. Unlike the judge at the beginning of this chapter, God's justice is not frustrated. He has the power to bring justice on both the living and the dead. God's perfect power enables him to apply his absolute justice. God can bring about true justice because he is all-powerful. God alone can ensure that the guilty do not remain unpunished. God is not only different from the dictator because he will not become corrupt, but also because he will never become self-serving. The dictator's only concern is himself. He will stop at nothing to ensure he keeps his power and will crush anything that gets in his way. The dictator's love is turned in on himself. But God does not suffer from self-love. Since God is Trinity, he will never become self-serving. If God were alone, his only concern would be for himself. A God who is alone has no one but himself to love. Yet as we've seen before, God is Trinity and therefore is not alone. He is three in one. Since the one God is Father, Son and Spirit, the persons have never been alone. They are in an eternal relationship and have no potential to become self-serving. The Father's concern is not for himself, but for his Son. And the Son does not seek his own glory, but serves his Father. The Spirit is the all-important third person in the relationship that ensures that the love between the two does not get swallowed up. Genuine love takes place between the three. Their desire is not to have glory for their own sake, but to bring glory to the others. Not long after learning to speak, we soon have cause to cry. That's not fair. It betrays that we expect someone to hear our cry and act accordingly. As children, we look to our parents for a solution. When we grow up, our desire for justice does not dissipate. We might articulate our concerns in a slightly more sophisticated way, or on other occasions use more colourful language. Whether it is the mundane, such as being held up at traffic lights because someone's distracted, or sentimental, like the theft of your mother's wedding ring, or as serious as the abuse of a child, we demonstrate we want a judge who not only hears our appeal, but who can act definitively. There is a judge, free from potential limitations. He knows all the information, the motives of every heart, and every word spoken in the quietness of every mind. He is powerful enough to bring about justice for every wrongdoing, and has authority over the living and the dead, and over heaven and over hell. This judge is God. The intention of this chapter has not just been to begin with our desire for justice and then explain that God fulfills that need. Rather, we have argued the reason for our desire for justice can only be explained because we reflect the one who has created us. It is only because he is just that we seek justice. Reflection, made to be like him. Chapter 4. Science. A toddler quickly learns how the world works. A jolly fat man with a wispy white beard delivers presents to every house in just one night. We pull out a loose tooth so a fairy can exchange it for money. Elves make the best shoes. We give them the gift of new clothes and they are set free. And if you're poor, what you really need is some magic beans to grow a beanstalk and find the goose that lays golden eggs. This is fun while it lasts, but eventually we grow out of our naivety and become a little more sophisticated. Thankfully, we leave our futile thinking behind. The physicist sets us straight with regards to Santa Claus. The weight of presents Santa's sleigh must carry and the speed it will travel will heat the reindeer up in the same fashion as spacecrafts re-entering the Earth's atmosphere. The lead pair of reindeer will absorb 14.3 quintillion joules of energy per second each. In short, they will burst into flame almost instantaneously, exposing the reindeer behind them, and create deafening sonic booms in their wake. The entire reindeer team will be vaporized within 4.26 thousandths of a second. Science provides us with the necessary reason we need to keep fantasy in its place. Along with Santa Claus, the Tooth Fairy, elves and giants, we also dismiss God. The toddler may believe that every time it rains, God has reached for his enormous watering can. By secondary school, such nonsense is replaced with an understanding of the water cycle and how rain is precipitation from clouds. As a young girl, she thought God laid the earth on gigantic foundations. However, she rejected the idea once it was explained that gravity maintains the Earth's orbit around the sun. Already suspicious about the claim that God caused the grass to grow, it made much more sense that plants actually grow when they take carbon dioxide from the air and light from the sun to photosynthesize glucose. As children embrace fantasy, adults confine it to entertainment. So we would expect anyone and everyone who has studied science, especially to degree level and beyond, to have left the mythology of God behind them as well. Before I became a pastor, I was a science teacher. Am I the one exception to the rule? No. My colleague Adrian taught maths. My wife is a doctor. We have university students who attend our church that study subjects from physiotherapy to engineering. A family friend is both a Christian and a heart consultant. There are as many scientists in the world who believe in God as any other profession. Why then do the media wish to promote the sentiment that belief in God is silly superstition, while promoting science as liberation from such nonsense? When Jimmy Carr talks about Jesus, he says, "We've all got imaginary friends. I've just grown out of mine." He suggests that to still believe in Jesus is as ridiculous as still believing in the tooth fairy. Why does he make fun of people who believe in God? He clearly believes no rational person should believe in God. We are led to believe that science and religion are one another's antithesis, and science, in our rational, intelligent society, must trump belief in God. What is either unknown or often forgotten is science and religion have not always been considered contrary to one another. There was a time when science and belief in the God who is Trinity went hand in hand. Polytheism is the belief in multiple gods and was practiced by ancient Egyptians, Greeks and Romans, among others. Each god was considered to be responsible for one aspect of creation. When thunderstruck, the god of thunder was angry. If a family was blessed with a baby, it was a gift from the god of fertility. When harvest was close, all attention went to the appropriate god. Each god had their part to play, and what happened in the world was attributed to the relevant god. This negated the need for investigation. There was no mystery that led to questions. Moreover, it was impossible to form a hypothesis of how the universe might operate. A hypothesis is a proposal to explain why something happens. If a plant is left next to a window, and after a day or two, all the leaves have turned to face the window, a hypothesis might be, in order to capture as much sunlight as possible, leaves turn towards light. To test if the hypothesis is true, the plant is turned away from the light to see if over time the leaves reconfigure to face the sun. Or a dark piece of card is placed over the lower leaves to block the light to see if the leaves covered behave differently to those exposed. In a polytheistic society, a hypothesis was never made. Everyone already knew why things happened. Plants grow because Demeter, the goddess of the harvest, causes them to grow. In the spring and summer, plants grow. In the autumn and winter, food does not grow. So a thoughtful individual might ask, why is Demeter distracted for half of the year? Well, it all began with a disagreement between the gods. Hades, the god of the underworld, is in love with Demeter's daughter, Persephone. But Demeter will never allow their marriage because Persephone would have to move to the underworld. Hades abducts Persephone. Demeter is so distraught at the loss of her daughter, she commits to finding Persephone and neglects her role. No plants grow. She finally discovers Hades has taken Persephone. Zeus demands Persephone is released because the people are hungry. But before Hades releases Persephone, he gives her a few pomegranate seeds to eat. Now she's eaten from the underworld. She's bound to spend half of the year with Hades. So Demeter causes the crops to grow in spring and summer, but is inconsolable and unable to function during autumn and winter, when Persephone returns to Hades. No one would think to theorise why the plants did grow or did not grow, because they already knew. The natural world was in the hands of the gods and their moods, which was temperamental at best. Who could know how they might act from one day to the next? There was no justification to think that what occurred one day might happen on another. The only way to ensure any sort of regularity in the world was to ensure all the gods remained appeased with the appropriate sacrifice or worship. This remained the case until the influence of monotheism, belief in one god, spread over large parts of the world. Monotheism provided a foundation for scientific experiment. One god meant there was a unity and integrity to the universe. It provided a regularity and order to the operation of the world, everything that was needed for scientific investigation. The events of the world are no longer considered to be the chaotic interaction of multiple deities, but rather the will of the one god. Instead of multiple gods, in a contest to overpower one another, one god controls everything. A hypothesis depends on there being a consistency to the world. It depends on the assumption that each event is not the random whim of a god or goddess, but what will happen one day will happen on others. So another plant, on a different windowsill, will also turn toward the light. God's existence ensures that there's a consistency to the world in which we live. It means that if an experiment is carried out today, under certain conditions, and the identical experiment is set up 10 years later, under those exact conditions, the outcome will be the same. We can exemplify this by considering a simple experiment. When a rock is held at a specific height and is released, we can observe what happens. The rock will fall to the ground. Thanks to the scientist, we can explain why. The gravitational pull of the Earth draws the rock towards the ground. We can repeat the experiment 5, 10, 15, 100 times, and each time under the same conditions, the rock falls to the ground. At which point, we can draw the conclusion. When a rock is released from a height, it will fall to the ground. A hypothesis makes the assumption that the world will not change from one day to the next. It assumes that there will not be any extreme changes in the gravitational pull, but it will remain relatively constant. It assumes that the gravitational pull will always be present, and it makes the assumption that the gravitational pull will never become the gravitational push. We expect gravity to remain the same. Scientists assume it will always remain the same. But what do they base their assumption upon? When we are in pain, we take paracetamol. Whether it is for a headache, sore tooth, or back pain, paracetamol is relied upon to bring relief to mild pain. If we are inclined, we can read about the active ingredient and mechanism that enables paracetamol to act as a painkiller. What we might be surprised to find is, though the nurse knows that paracetamol is effective, there is no complete clarity on how it works. The general understanding is, paracetamol inhibits a specific enzyme. Once again, the scientist makes the assumption that because paracetamol acts upon that specific enzyme today, it will do so tomorrow and forevermore. The scientific assumption is, if the conditions remain the same, the result will be the same, But what do they base this assumption upon? The atheist scientist has a problem. What is the assumption that the world has regularity and order based upon? The scientist cannot lose the assumption, otherwise he or she will be unable to do any experiments. How then can it be explained? We may be quick to respond with the laws of nature. Surely they provide us with the assumption we need to carry out science. However, the laws of nature are merely observations made by scientists that they know to be constant. They describe that there is an order to creation, but they do not explain what provides the order. As we have already considered, the Trinity means God is three in one. So can't the same argument be made against Christianity as that made against polytheism? Do the events of history become the random whim of the Father, Son, and Spirit? How does the God who is Father, Son, and Spirit bring order and regularity to his creation? Islam and Judaism are critical of Christianity, accusing it of not being genuine monotheism on account of the Father, Son, and Spirit each being God. They reject the idea of the Trinity three-in-one God as being a mathematical impossibility. Either Father, Son, and Spirit are each God, and as a result, Christianity does not believe in one God but three gods, or the Son and Spirit are not God, and only the Father is the true God. What is agreed by those who oppose the teaching of the Trinity is that God cannot be three in one. There is much that has been written in response to this controversy, but the aspect that is most pertinent to our discussion is how the Trinity is not about maths, because God is not made of matter. Many, if not all, illustrations of the Trinity fall short because they rely on items that are made of matter and have parts. St. Patrick, the patron saint of Ireland, is credited with having used the three-leaf clover as an illustration of the Trinity. Hence, the shamrock is Ireland's national symbol. The three leaves of the shamrock represent Father, Son, and Spirit, while the clover plant as a whole represents the one God. However, the shamrock is not three in one, but each leaf is one part of the overall clover plant. Is water a better illustration? In winter, the children skate on the lake because it's solid. Later in the year, the lake takes the place of the local swimming pool. In the blazing sun, the liquid evaporates to vapour. Solid, liquid, or gas, each is still water. However, that is not like the Trinity, because water changes from one state to another. The Father does not change in order to become the Son or Spirit. Rather, God is always Father, Son, and Spirit. How then do we understand what it means to be three in one? One of the concerns of polytheism, as we have considered above, is that there are multiple gods, each vying for power. Each god has his or her objective, and the god who stands in another's way will need to be overpowered. If Christianity is polytheistic, we would see the same pattern within the Trinity. Father, Son, and Spirit each have a valid claim to the throne. Each is God, and they would tussle to gain advantage over the other two. Yet the Bible is clear that this is not the case. Instead, there is a complete unity found in the intent and purpose of the Trinity. Each member of the Trinity plays a unique part, but all work toward the same goal. The goal is recreation. Having looked at the issues of justice and suffering, there is no need to revisit the discussion that this world is broken. It is spoilt. But why? In popular culture, Adam and Eve are depicted as a little naughty. They indulged their desire for something prohibited. They tasted forbidden fruit. But how does this explain the dire straits of the world? Much effort has gone into determining which fruit Adam and Eve ate. Was it an apple, pear, or apricot? But this misses the point. The central issue is Adam and Eve's attitude towards God. When they eat the fruit, they challenge the integrity of God's word. God said, "You may surely eat of every tree of the garden, but of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat, for in the day that you eat of it, you will surely die." It is so often overlooked that before the single prohibition, God generously provides every tree of the garden for food. However, Adam and Eve do not believe that God is generous. They think he's preventing them from becoming like him. They think God is a liar. This has serious implications. It was by God's word that God created the world. The existence of the universe depends on God's word and it being true. If the integrity of God's word is questioned, so is creation. When Adam and Eve eat of the tree, they de-create the world. The world is devastated, and God's plan is to fix it. Each person of the Trinity has a distinct role to play in this act of recreation. To recreate the world, God must vindicate his word. He said to Adam and Eve, "In the day that you eat of the tree, you will surely die." The early church father Athanasius teased out the problem. If God does not carry out what he says, God's word is false. He is a liar, and everything he says before or after is also questioned. The alternative is no better. If God keeps his word, then he must bring his creation to ruin. Humanity dies, and this too is unfitting that God should fail to keep those he created. God solves both these problems when he sends his Son. The Son remains part of the Trinity, while also taking on a human nature. He is the God-man. This means he can succeed where Adam failed. Instead of compromising God's word, the Son obeys his Father. However, humanity shows the same hostility towards God that Adam and Eve demonstrated. They turn on the Son and kill him. Since the Son is a man and dies, he fulfills God's word. You will surely die. He dies in our place. Since he is God, he can die for many people, not just take the place of one. Once the Son has been raised from the dead and has returned to the Father, the Spirit is sent to convict the hearts of people that have spent a lifetime ignoring God. The Father, Son, and Spirit have one united plan: to restore the world and prevent creation coming to ruin. Each member of the Trinity implements a different aspect of the same plan. This is a brief explanation, but we see the three roles are intertwined in achieving the one purpose. The Father's role includes sending. He sends the Son and Spirit. Instead of setting their own agenda, the Son and Spirit obey the Father. We have begun to see something of what it means for God to be Trinity. Three persons with distinct roles working towards one united plan. You may well be asking, this is all very well, but how does this relate to science? Unlike polytheism, monotheism only has one God who controls all things. The three persons of the Trinity do not compromise this, because they all work according to the Father's will. Not only is God's plan one in intent and purpose, but it does not change or falter. There is not the chaos that is found in a world where gods are in constant conflict, and what happens next cannot be predicted. Instead, God is unchanged, and his character remains consistent. This means God provides the potential for a hypothesis to be formed. Since he is consistent, his creation is ordered and regular. What will happen today will happen tomorrow. We can test our hypotheses and start to learn about the world God has created. So if the basis for scientific investigation can only be found in monotheism, why must it be Trinitarian monotheism and not something else? The world we live in and explore through science is bursting with reflections of the Trinitarian God who made it. Consider the ecosystem as a whole. There is a unity to the ecosystem. Every aspect of the ecosystem plays its part to sustain it. The plants provide the food for the animals. The animals provide fecal matter for the microbes. And the microbes decompose dead organic matter and replenish the soil with nutrients for plants to take up. The plants take energy from the sun and carbon dioxide from the air and provide food for the animals. The unity in the ecosystem means every part has its role, and if one is missing, the whole cycle falls apart. If we consider the ecosystem from a different perspective, we see that there is a diversity to the ecosystem. If there are only animals, it would not work. The animals are not able to turn carbon dioxide from the air and use the energy from the sunlight to photosynthesize glucose. The animals need plants to eat. If there are only plants, the soil would quickly run out of nutrients. If there is no nitrogen for the plant to take from the soil, it cannot make the chlorophyll necessary for photosynthesis. The plant depends on the microbes that decompose organic material, so it can absorb nutrients through its roots. While there is a unity to the ecosystem, each member has a distinct role to play, so there is also a great diversity. As the scientist observes the world, they see unity and diversity. A God who is not Trinity cannot account for both unity and diversity. Polytheism is diverse. Multiple gods with very different characteristics, giving no assurance for unity. Whereas it is in the Trinity that we see unity, in the oneness of God, and diversity in the threeness of God. The world that God has made reflects himself. The scientist who is a Christian never needs to make the assumption that what happens one day will happen the next. Rather, he or she knows that ultimately the same God causes the sun to rise in the morning and to set at night. Since God is consistent in his character, his creation reflects an order and regularity that means what happens one day will happen the next day, as well as in a year's time and in the centuries to come. The scientist who is a Christian, be she a little girl growing cress seeds, or a researcher discovering a cure for cancer, carries out her investigation because the world has one creator who is unchanging throughout all of eternity. Instead of science undermining Christianity, science depends upon the existence of an unchanging creator. Reflection. Made to be like him. Chapter 5. Reflection. It is Friday evening. Old friends are having a drink. Alf begins a monologue about his wife. I like to think of Sandra as being 6 foot tall, with long dark hair. She is as slim as she is tall, an intellect. She loves to read the work of the great philosophers. Late into the night, she relays to me all that she's learnt, while together we sip a glass of red wine. Despite our late nights, she loves nothing more to wake up early the next morning, when she cooks a full breakfast for us both to enjoy. As I enter the kitchen, she's listening to opera. We sit down to grapefruit and a cafetiere of coffee. His friends look at one another. One sniggers. That may well be how you like to think of Sandra, but we know her. Yeah, and I'd be careful if I were you. If she gets wind of how you talk about her, she won't be best pleased. I would keep your daydreams to yourself. His friends are right. It might be how he likes to think of his wife, but not one detail is true. Think how upset his 4-foot-6-inch wife would feel, with her short grey hair. How can he mistake her early to bed, late to rise? Far from a love of great philosophers, her time is spent searching the gossip pages. She will not touch red wine. She likes a nice cup of tea. And for breakfast, she snatches a banana, while giving the kids their breakfast. Not one element of what she hears would be welcome. Instead, she would be devastated at being misrepresented, hurt as she wonders who her husband is actually describing, and no doubt have some serious misgivings about the future of their marriage. His behaviour is atrocious, because he treats her as an object, not as a person. He is more concerned with what he would like a wife to be, and will not allow his wife to show herself as she really is. We expect to be known as we are, not how people would like us to be. This raises a crucial question. If we do not like to be misrepresented, why do we think it's appropriate to misrepresent God? Because this is exactly what we do, and it's the main way we show hostility towards God. This is played out when we say, I like to think of God as... There are many and varied ways by which people finish that sentence. Yet the problem is not how the sentence is finished. The start of the sentence has already set us on the wrong path. I decide what I think God should be like, and I refuse to allow God to disclose himself to me as he really is. God is like Sandra in the illustration. He can reveal to us what he's like, but, like Alf, we would rather think of him as we see fit. Consider the man who says, I like to think of God as made of chocolate. Clearly, God being made of chocolate will cause many problems. Least of all, how does he prevent himself from melting? However, that is not the problem here. Instead, our concern is, if God has not told us he is made of chocolate, how can we think he is made of chocolate? If God is not made of chocolate, it does not matter how much we like to think of him as such, it will not impact the reality that God is not made of chocolate. This is the difference between believing in a God, one that we conjure up from our own imagination, and believing in the God, who has revealed himself and done so as Trinity. Our insistence that we can decide what God is like is one way we are hostile towards God. You may be thinking, but I don't believe there is a God. Yet the problem remains the same. The statement could be rephrased, I like to think of God as not existing. To deny God's existence is just another way of determining what he is like, or in this case, that he is not like anything, while refusing to listen to the God who makes himself known. Another way that we reject God can be exemplified by the toddler who slaps her father around the face. The toddler is too short to reach her father's face. The toddler depends on her father holding her in his arms so she can reach his face. If the father were to put the toddler down, she'd be unable to slap him. We are like this toddler. Throughout this book, the argument has been, whatever we do because we reflect our Creator. We love because God is in an eternal relationship, and we love like him. We hate suffering because God determines what's right and wrong. We seek justice because he is just. We can explore and understand our world because of the constancy God brings. But it is more than this. God gives us life, and he sustains our life. He created the world in which we live, and it is designed as a perfect habitat for us. While we understand that the earth orbits round the sun, this in no way infers that it's not God who keeps everything spinning. He provides us with the breath we breathe and the rain that falls, so food will grow for us to eat. God provides us with everything we need to live, and he gives us our logic to understand it. Our response is to use our breath and reason to justify why God does not exist. The paradox is seen when the atheist argues God does not exist because suffering exists and suffering is wrong. The atheist only knows that suffering is wrong because he reflects the one he says does not exist. To make a case against God, we must rely upon what God has given us. We behave like this because everyone follows in the steps of our oldest ancestors, Adam and Eve. God gave them life, and he made them in his image, so they would think his thoughts after him. God provided them with everything they needed to sustain life. He then spoke to them. How they responded was crucial. They could believe God, or declare him a liar. Yet having been created by God, the only means available to evaluate God's word was to use the gifts God gave them. They used the knowledge God gave them to deny the truth of his word. They thought they knew what God was like, and they believed him to be a liar. All of their descendants follow in their steps. Everyone thinks they know what God is like, and no one is willing to listen to the God who makes himself known. What can be done about our hostility towards God? Many people do not see it as a problem. If anything is known about God, it is that he is in the business of forgiveness, and he will overlook our apathy towards him. It is beneath God to be vindictive. He watches us continue in our ignorance. He gives us the time we need to do our own thing. He patiently waits, ready to usher us into heaven when we die. What we have done in the here and now is of no consequence. Everyone has their own words to describe it. Whether they join the party in the sky, or they become an additional voice among the angels. God shows no distinction, and lets everyone into his heavenly abode. The difficulty with such a position is it contradicts our own concern that the guilty should be punished. On the one hand, we believe God will not condemn, yet on the other hand, we want the guilty to be condemned. In chapter 3, we argued, the reason we have an innate desire for justice is because we've been created by the ultimate judge. This desire for justice is because he made us, and it will be met because he can and will bring complete justice. But what should God's judgment be on the hostility we have shown him? Our tendency is not only to dismiss such hostility, but in our narrative we become the heroes as we rebel against the tyrannical God, glamorizing our hostility. Justice needs to be brought against the great evils of humanity, but as far as crimes against the Creator, there is no case to answer. Genocide, murder, sexual assault, these are the crimes we want justice for. Compared to this, our rebellion against God is insignificant. Before we accept this conclusion, there is more to consider. Genocide, murder, and sexual assault are crimes against fellow image bearers. When one human murders another, he or she kills a person who bears the image of God. Rather than making the culprit less culpable, the crime is much worse. To take another human's life is bad enough, but to bring an end to one who reflects the character of his or her creator shows the offence is not only against the human, but also against the one who made them. To kill a person is to take the life of a fellow image bearer. This is an indirect offence against God. Our rebellion against God himself is a direct offence against the one whose image we bear. What happens when the restraint on our hostility is lifted? There are two particular points in history when the constant hostility we show towards God was heightened. The first we've already mentioned, when Adam and Eve dismissed God as a liar. The second was when God's Son lived alongside us as a man, himself. Humanity's hostility towards God was demonstrated when a plot for Jesus' death was planned and put into action, leading to a trial plagued with false evidence and culminating in a death sentence carried out on a cross. This is where it pinches. Given half a chance, man will murder his maker. This presents us with a problem. We have been made to be personal. Particularly, we have been made to have a relationship with our Creator. But far from being able to reconcile with God, we deny there is even a problem. Yet our relationship with our Creator needs to be fixed. There is nothing we can do to solve such a problem. When you stack up our hostility towards God, it does not bode well. We decide if there is a God, what we should be like, or we use the reason he has given us to deny his existence. Then, when his Son enters his creation to live alongside us, humanity kills him. We might think the solution is simple. Instead of creating God in our image, we need to recognize that we are created in his image. Instead of deciding what he is like, we listen to how he makes himself known to us. While this is true, something else needs to be done about our hostility. When God created the world, he did not intend for us to die. Death is the verdict of our rebellion towards God. When we read of the account of Jesus' death, it can appear that a vulnerable man was hauled in front of a corrupt justice system. However, it's not quite as simple as this. Every event that leads to Jesus' death was carefully planned by the Father, and the Son willingly laid down his life. Why would they do such a thing? God created the world, and he created us in his image. Death means his beloved creation will come to ruin. So in order that this does not happen, he provides a sacrifice that is sufficient to bring an end to death and reconcile a hostile humanity to God. Once we've been reconciled to God, We will put our hostility aside and want to get to know him. But how do we get to know God? The answer is the Bible. This is the record of God's revelation of himself to us. People sometimes dismiss the Bible, insisting that it is archaic. How can something written so long ago have any relevance for us? We must remember who the author of the Bible is. God is the creator, who provides the regularity and order there must be in the world so we can carry out scientific investigation. It means what happens one day will happen another day, under the same conditions. It means that the creator does not change but remains the same. God is the same today as he always has been. How God has acted in the past, as recorded in the Bible centuries ago, is still an accurate revelation of what God is like now. In order to get to know God, we can read about what he is like. Since God is consistent, scientists can carry out scientific investigation. This consistency is the same reason the Christian has confidence in God. While a promise that God made more than 2,000 years ago may hardly seem relevant now, 2,000 years ago, if a rock was dropped from a height, it would have been drawn to the ground because of gravity. That remains true today. So too, when 2,000 years ago, God promised that our condemnation was placed upon Jesus, and that we can be reconciled to our Creator because Jesus died in our place, that promise remains true in the here and now and forevermore. This book is only a brief introduction. Its purpose is to challenge you to consider why we love, why we believe suffering is wrong, why we desire justice, and how we can carry out scientific investigation. There are many who would consider Christianity to be a tradition that has no part to play in contemporary life. However, the aim of this book is not only to argue that Christianity is credible, but that everything we do and hold dear to comes from the fact that we've been created in the image of the God who is Trinity. God is not merely credible, rather we depend on him for everything we are and do. This is why the title of this book is Reflection, Made to Be Like Him. As men and women who bear God's image, we are a reflection of his character. Whoever you are, you have been made to be like him. And that explains a great deal of who you are. If reading this book has given you the desire to know more, then come and take part in the course, The God Who Makes Himself Known. Many of us have never read the Bible, and our only knowledge of it is second-hand. The God Who Makes Himself Known is a course that explains what the Bible is about and gives you an opportunity to understand it for yourself. It is made up of 7 studies. In each study, we read a section of the Bible and then consider some related questions. Through understanding the Bible, God shows who he is and tells us of his plan for the world. The God of the Bible is the God who makes himself known. The God who makes himself known will be running throughout the year. If you'd like more details, please email contactus@trinitychurchbradford.org.uk. Reflection, Made to Be Like Him. Copyright Tom Swinney, 2018. Published by Trinity Ministries. Unless otherwise indicated, scripture quotations are from ESV Bible, the Holy Bible English Standard Version, published by HarperCollins Publishers, 2001 by Crossway, used by permission, all rights reserved. All rights reserved except as may be permitted by the Copyright Act. No part of this publication may be reproduced in any form or by any means without prior permission from the publisher.